to another episode of the NBeta podcast. It's been a while since we've posted any episodes, and the reason is that Ben and I are busy organizing the first NBeta Unconference, which we're calling Experiments in Physiotherapy Education. It's going to take place on the 14th and 15th of May at the School of Health Sciences in Lausanne, immediately after the WCPT conference. The Unconference is free to attend, but participants will need to register and arrange their own transport and accommodation. You can find out more at nbeta.uwc.ac.za/unconference. Another announcement is that the consumer version of Google Plus is shutting down on the 2nd of April. This means that if you normally get your new episode notifications via Google Plus, you'll need to go to the NBeta website, subscribe there in order to get the email notifications for new episodes. We're also hoping to build more functionality into the site over time. A final housekeeping item is to check out the projects page on the website, which has been updated with a few more examples of classroom activities that we think have been quite useful in our own practice. If you've got any learning and teaching projects you'd like to share with the community, please let us know via the contact page on the site. And now on with today's episode. This is our first Ask Me Anything podcast, where Ben and I decided that we'd ask each other three questions without any preparation and then simply record the conversation. We talk about the value of grading, whether or not learning should be fun, the purpose of relationship between students and lecturers, the value of social media, and our best teaching moments of 2018. Okay, so Ben, welcome. So today it was your idea that we were just going to throw each other some questions. We haven't seen these questions. We haven't seen each other's questions. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to ask.
Yeah, no, good. So I'm also slightly apprehensive, but I'm definitely interested to see what questions you come up with. So I think this was just off the back of kind of that end of year feeling, reflecting back a bit. Are there things that you know, either of us have kind of thought about or heard each other talking about, or, you know, that we kind of wanted to get into a little bit more? So an opportunity to sort of do that, not spend too long on each one, but just kind of have a bit of a talk around a couple of things that are on our minds.
All right, cool. Well, should I go first?
You go first. Go for it.
All right. Okay. So my first question is, what do you think is more important, the process or the outcome? So if we think about student learning, is it more important what students go through as part of the learning tasks that we set them? Or is it more important that they arrive at some satisfactory answer?
Okay, so if you're framing it like that, then I think the process is more important than the outcome. I don't think the outcome of arriving at a set answer is as important as having gone through a satisfactory process to arrive at it. But having said that, I don't think the outcome has to be arriving at the answer. So if the outcome of the process is that the student is better able to do a similar process in the future, or understands the process better and understands them, you know, their own ability to arrive at, or even understands what kind of answer they might be trying to arrive at, then I think all of those might be good outcomes that we should be aiming for. So I guess then, The question then is kind of how do we work out whether or not that is happening? And so assessment, I guess, has to be part of that process to work out, you know, what is occurring in this. Is there any learning occurring? Are we seeing some sort of movement towards, you know, the professional that we want the person to become? Because I think we'd be confident to say that at the start of a degree program, the students aren't there, and we want them to be there by the end, you know, so kind of having something that to jump through. So I guess I would say that assessment is important, but it's really important for us to be assessing what the outcomes are that we might be interested in. So if we set the outcome up around like arriving at the correct answer, and we've got this defined idea what that correct answer is, and we're just kind of waiting for the student to say that thing so we can kind of feel good about ourselves that they learned the thing that we told them and put a big tick there, then that seems less helpful than if we're assessing their ability to, you know, process and reason and kind of justify. And even if the answer that they provide to us is like not one that we would come up with, but we can follow the reasoning, then we should be comfortable with that, and that should be something that we're going for. So I guess my answer to the question would be, yes, I think assessment is important, but I think the thing we assess is important.
So I think we're on the same page. I agree that I think the process is more important. I just wonder how much of assessment in physiotherapy education focuses on assessing students' kind of thinking. In my experience, a lot of assessment focuses on students getting the right answer. And if that's really the process is about, i.e. students getting the right answer, then I think we're on the wrong track. Because they're gonna forget those answers, you know, 2 months later when they move on to a new module. So that's what I was just wondering. You know, if what we're doing is trying to get students to think, and that the outcome isn't really that important, then maybe it would be useful to actually forego the assessment process completely, and just to say to students, right, just do this work. And in doing the work, like if you are using learning theory to build your assessments or to build your learning tasks, then you can be fairly confident that simply by doing the work, the students will be developing in how they think. And so the completion of the task should be enough to move students. I think that...
But then I guess the question there would be, what do you mean by completion of the task? So is that kind of... who's deciding when the task is complete? So we've all had that experience of like setting a task, and then maybe we set a group task and there's like 10 groups, and a couple of those groups do this fantastic thing and have clearly learned a load from it, and a couple really haven't, but they have put stuff down against all of the components of the task, like there is output against it. But does that output represent an engagement with, you know, the learning outcomes that we were trying to get to with it? Not necessarily. Yeah. So if it requires us to judge whether the task has been complete, so if that needs me to kind of provide feedback against the task to say, oh, I think you really need to think about this a bit more, or go into more depth here, or have you thought about this? Then I'm still assessing, aren't I? That's not an examination, but it's like it's an assessment that I'm still providing. So I definitely think there's more space for that. If we're then thinking about the format of assessment, moving away from exams, which kind of by their nature have to have a correct answer, because that's how you have to write them, and everyone gets very uptight about writing exam questions that can't be interpreted in any other way, so that it's not confusing for anyone sitting that exam. Like, absolutely, but I wouldn't be convinced that by setting a learning task and kind of just the students completing that isn't assessment in some way. I think it's maybe just a different form. Yeah.
I think we're agreed. And now that after the talking about it, I'm wondering if the question was actually, is grading necessary? We don't have to answer that question.
No, but I think that's a really interesting. And definitely, I think we touched on that already this year. I feel like we have, or I definitely have with other people. We had the conversation before about how different university, how different countries, maybe their degree system. What the output is, so there's a very strong emphasis on the grading from the student's perspective. I think everywhere we agreed, but that different places have more of an emphasis then on providing like a grade point average or like a degree classification, like in the first sort of 2-1, 2-2 that we have in the UK, or whether people graduate with like a specific form of title or whatever it might be. My take on that one is that in terms of progressing to be a physio, the grading doesn't matter. So having like there's a relatively clear cutoff that if you haven't passed, you're not at the level that would be required to be a physiotherapist, and anyone who reaches the pass mark is. I don't think in terms of being a physio, the grading matters beyond that. So you could just not have the grading, but then you're operating within an academic system where you know, there are people are definitely performing to different levels of, like, you know, academic rigor and thinking in what they're doing. And I don't necessarily have a problem with kind of there being some reflection of that. But it's getting the balance, isn't it? You know, so it's, but it, it, I think if we're going to grade, we need everyone to be bought into what the grading represents. So we've been trying to definitely do some work around, you know, I definitely have an issue with, like, using a percentage grade. So that feeds into this idea of, like, oh, I was 1% off of this or 2% off of this, like, as if, as if 1% or 2% of, like, thinking is something that we could even conceive of. So, you know, we've really, across all of the modules that we do, we still give, well, the system still requires us to put a number on it, but we've been really clear that we're going to give you a band. So you're either in, like, a 50%, like a 50s band or a 60s band or a 70s band, and we're then going to give you a high, medium or low score in that band. So the only mark, you're going to see a mark that's either going to be a 63, a 65 or a 67. But what that's telling you is that you are not in the top mark band, you're in the one below that, and you're towards the top of that or towards the bottom of it. So think of it as terms of a band. Don't obsess on the number, because it's not like if you said two more things, you could have got 2% more to get there. It's right. Like the quality of the reasoning, whatever you were doing, needs to take, like, a step change to go from a 67 to a 73. And, like, we purposely made that a bigger gap between those than it would be between, like, a 67 and a 65. So these are, like, these numbers are quite close together in the same kind of mark bracket. But to jump from this bracket to this bracket, you've got it. It's the marks are relatively far apart, and it's making us make clear decisions. So where somebody might have previously come out at, like, a 60, we've now got to make a decision. Are they really a 57 or a 63? And that's been it feels useful from an academic's perspective to have to make that call, not just kind of sit on the fence with it. And it's making us think about more, are we comfortable with the bracket we're putting students in? And I think if we can then shift their understanding of that, then the grading is still helpful, because it's then understanding what is it that would look different if you were getting a mark in the higher on in the next bracket up. But it's not really about the mark, it's about, like, the step change between the sort of, you know, the different levels, whether that's in how much prompting or support you're needing to get there, or whether it's about how much independent stuff you bring in on top of the basics that we might have gone through in the talk content, you know. And then you can be clearer about what it is that would be required for someone to be performing at that high level, and try and use the feedback to sort of show the students how their learning can progress, I think.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I really like that approach. Now, I think we may need to have a separate episode just on grading, because I think it would be really useful to kind of flesh out some of those ideas that you've been talking about now. Cool. Well, I think we've sorted, done.
Sorted, done, tick. Yeah. one problem done. Okay, good. I'm going to go straight for it. So my first question then is, should learning be fun?
Yeah. I would go further and say that learning cannot be fun. That's what I'm gonna kind of stake my claim there, plant that flag in the ground. So I think we need to distinguish between the different words that we use to talk about learning. So when I talk about learning, when I say learning, I'm very specifically referring to the cognitive process that's happening in the student's mind. So learning is the thing that happens in the student's brain that helps them to move from a lower conceptual understanding to a higher conceptual understanding. What I think people tend to conflate with that cognitive process are the tasks and other peripheral activities that happen around the process of learning. So the task of the teacher is to create a learning environment in which learning can happen. And how well we create that environment is some kind of proxy indicator of how well learning can take place. So your lecturing style may be, you know, really boring and kind of banal. So you're not creating an interesting and engaging environment for the students to learn. Your learning environment can be not conducive to learning. So The chairs may be uncomfortable. The air conditioning may not work and the students may be freezing cold. Social conditions may not be conducive to learning. So students come in and they're hungry, or they're coming from, you know, abusive families and family environments, or they've just spent 2 hours on public transport. Those are all peripheral to the process of learning, which is the thing that's happening inside the head of the student. So when I say that learning cannot be fun, I mean that it's the cognitive process of moving from lower to a higher conceptual understanding. If we're talking about learning tasks, learning activities, lecturing, learning environments, there's no reason that those things can't have fun elements. But learning in itself, I'm not convinced that it can be fun or that it should be fun. So if you think about any difficult idea that you've ever had to engage with, and learning in physiotherapy is about moving through a kind of a graded system of more and more difficult ideas, you need someone to help guide you to those higher levels of understanding. And that in itself is cognitively difficult. And I think also I must be clear that when I say fun, I don't mean enjoyable. So learning something that's difficult can be enjoyable. You can come out of that with a sense of achievement, satisfaction, but I'm not sure that it can be fun.
So I guess my question here would be, firstly, that the conception you're having here is of moving from like a lower conceptual understanding to a higher conceptual understanding. And that is learning, but is that the only type of learning that there is? Because it would seem to me like that's a very specific type of learning, and that is undoubtedly a challenging type of learning. But within a conceptual level, we're still going to be learning, you know, knowledge or skills or whatever that operate with that doesn't change our conceptual level, but is still learning. And so, yep. Can that sort of learning be fun? Can it be fun apply to any sort of learning, or only learning that moves us from one conceptual level to another?
I think, yeah, that's a good point. So you can learn about things through direct experience, and you can learn about things that you can only, or there are some things that you can only learn about through the direct experience of others. So an easy example is that you can learn when you drop any kind of object anywhere on the planet, it falls from your hand to the floor. That's something that you can learn about, and that kind of learning can be fun. Any game that that children play where they're throwing balls around, they will learn about gravity, they will learn about trajectory, and that can be fun. That's learning, that's the kind of knowledge that you can gain through direct experience. But a single person, will never in their lifetime discover a theory of gravity, because each of the things that you need to learn what gravity is will take longer than you have time in your life to figure out. So that kind of deep learning, you build on the knowledge of others that have come before you. And in order to make those conceptual leaps, because remember, these are things that you have no direct experience of. So you're learning through what Vygotsky calls the more knowledgeable other. So you're progressing through a zone of proximal development where you are progressing from your conceptual understanding to a higher level of conceptual understanding. And the only way for you to reach that higher level is through the guidance of someone who is more knowledgeable than you. And that more knowledgeable other can be a book. So it's through reading what other people have learned through research, through experience, and building on top of that. So I think you're right. There are kind of simple things that we can learn about the world that don't require that more knowledgeable other. And those are the kinds of things that maybe you can have fun in your classroom, and you can get the students to do things and experience things, and those activities may be fun. But I think that the kind of learning that we really value are the difficult conceptual leaps that students need to make. I think if you're only ever going to focus on the relatively easy things to grasp, then it's going to take you, you know, well, I don't know. I don't know if you can ever graduate as a physiotherapist, because so much of what we are trying to teach students requires them to make those conceptual leaps. So we can maybe say that learning within those conceptual levels can be fun, but I would argue, who cares? If that's all we ever do, then they're only ever going to stay in first year.
Yeah. Okay. No, I think that makes more sense to me. And I think so. Obviously, this came out of something that you put out on Twitter and got a bit of pushback on. And I think that it was a challenge to mine and it seemed to other people's kind of direct experience, in that we could all kind of see something where we couldn't do a task or perform a skill or didn't know about something or couldn't remember something, but that then we could have done something which was kind of subjectively clearly fun, and at the end of it we could do that skill better, or and lots of things like that. That kind of experiential learning, it you need the fun to hook you into it. Like if I didn't enjoy playing football, like I wouldn't continue to play football and I wouldn't get better. I wouldn't be learning how to be more accurate with any pass or shot that I might take. So there is clearly learning that is happening in a fun way, but that's not about conceptual level. So I think I agree that the kind of, in order to get to where we're wanting to get to by the end of the degree, students are going to have engaged in learning which hasn't been fun to get them there. So I think in the way that you fleshed that out there, I have less of a problem with it. but I think that I guess then the question is kind of, okay, how often do we require students to make those conceptual leaps? Like if we're trying to do that every single session, that's not feasible, is it, either? Do you know what I mean? So do we need to think really carefully then about, I mean, obviously it's a challenge because every student's going to do it at a different point. And we shouldn't, I don't think, try and structure exactly like build up to this aha moment where they suddenly all like make this collective great leap forward into the next higher level of consciousness as a cohort. Like that's not how it happens. But if our focus is always on like challenging everything more and kind of undermining like the knowledge that someone has just got, and we need to have that knowledge undermined, but we can't have it undermined like as soon as we've got it, because like that just like totally leaves people feeling adrift. So there needs to be some balance there, I think, doesn't there, between how often we ask for that push and that leap forward, and how often we just kind of allow people to play within that area and feel more skilled at operating on the level that they're at.
I think, I definitely take your point. And I think the other thing to maybe mention is that the comment that I made on Twitter was in direct response to something that had been said at this conference. And, that's something that I eventually realized is that, Twitter is an awful platform to try and have any kind of nuanced conversation. It took me, how long did it take me to explain like what I was thinking when I, that's what I was thinking when I made the comment. But, to write that out on Twitter would just be a waste of everyone's time. The other thing is that the thing that I was responding to was someone who was demonstrating an app. And the, Blaze, picked it up almost immediately because I explained in one of my tweets. I said, look, this was in response to this thing where this guy was just saying, basically all we need to do to fix learning is to make our apps more fun. And that is such a, he's so off the mark. He's not even wrong. And so it was in response to that where I was saying no, it's not about just making your app more fun. Learning is actually hard. And so that was kind of the spirit of the original tweet. And then just to kind of come back to what you were saying now, I agree that not not everything. We can't be undermining students with increasingly difficult challenges every single time we see them. They need time to kind of take on the new concept, cross their threshold. Like as Sarah said in that podcast, they need to cross the threshold, and crossing the threshold is the difficult part because you're moving into a new paradigm, and so that's the difficult part. But then they need to spend time in that new space. And so maybe that's the opportunity for you to do learning activities, which can have fun elements, which reinforce what they've just learned. But again, I think that we can distinguish between learning, which is the kind of the cognitive work that students have to do, and all learning is cognitive work. And we must differentiate that from the kinds of activities that we ask students to do. So there can be fun in the activity. There can be fun in the social interaction. But I'm not sure that learning at any level can be fun.
I mean, maybe it's just like a value-free thing. I don't know. You know, does it, like, is your argument that it can't be fun, it is definitely something else? Or is it just not any of these? So, like, any activity can be fun or hard or easy or whatever, but the learning is kind of separated out from that.
Yeah, I don't know if I would talk about like use fun in the same like sentence or the same kind of category of things as hard, difficult, easy. You know, I think what you said now is probably right. I'm not sure that fun is really a category of ideas that fit in the concept of learning. Tasks can be difficult, they can be easy, they can be enjoyable. So you can get a real sense of achievement when you feel like you've solved a difficult problem. I don't know. It's not like I'm against fun. I'm not against students having fun. I'm just not convinced that the cognitive work that we require students to do can be fun. So I don't know. I'm not. Maybe I'm wrong. But these are my kind of. This is where I'm at in the way that I think about it.
I don't disagree with anything that you're saying. I think the differentiation between the learning that's happening and the task or activity that is operating with it, and the difference between things which, you know, might build skills within a level and or ability to work within a certain level, and those that are going to push onto a different. Like I feel like I definitely agree with that. I'm not totally sure that I go with you that fun is entirely of a different order of things, because you seem happier with enjoyable could be equatable into there, but I just think we're going to get into a kind of semantic discussion then about, like, yeah. Well, what, you know, what I call fun, exactly. You might call enjoyable or whatever, like, you know, so I totally understand where that's coming from in a kind of, you know, what you don't want is it for this to become like, oh, it's about being like wacky fun, do you know what I mean, like on a very sort of surface level of like engagement that, like, yeah, doesn't challenge anybody beyond that. I completely get the thing you're pushing back against. I wonder if in pushing back against that, that's kind of hardened your your vocabulary in some sense, because fun is the terminology that's maybe used more around like that particular kind of digital learning app type thing, and you know, so I don't think we disagree in the concept. I think maybe you're being just more hardline than you really are on fun as a term.
I think another point that I should make is I have a real concern that in kind of privileging fun in some way, we make that the objective. So rather than thinking about, you know, what is the activity that's going to help students to learn more effectively, I may change my thinking to saying, what is the activity that's going to be the most fun? And so I do have a very real concern that if we're going to try and design activities to be fun, we may lose sight of the fact that, you know, students didn't sign up to the physiotherapy program to have fun. They signed up to become physiotherapists. And so learning activities should always be designed to move us towards that objective rather than the objective of having fun. And so, again, not to say that those two things can't coexist, but we shouldn't privilege fun over learning. And as I've said, I'm not sure that learning can be fun. So, anyway.
That, I think that feels like we fleshed that one out slightly more than we were able to in 280 characters. And
now that I've articulated my position, I'm sure that there will be no pushback at all.
No, I think we can all just line up in agreement on that one now.
Indeed.
I've got another one for you now, and I think this kind of touches on some of the things that we've been speaking about. Do you think that student-teacher relationships really matter? So we talk about this idea of relationship-centered learning, that the better relationship you have with your students, the more likely they are to learn. Is it possible that that's too much of a touchy-feely concept and that it doesn't really matter?
Okay, that's a good one. I need to think. So I think that there are going to be some real differences in how you could view that. If I'm going from my experience, like I would definitely feel that the teacher can matter now. So now, is that because of the relationship that I had with the teacher, or is that because of like how they thought about teaching and how they structured learning and everything else? So, you know, I would definitely say, so there are definitely people, teachers who I had a good relationship with, who I didn't think were very good teachers, and teachers who I thought were quite good teachers who I didn't necessarily have a very good relationship with. So it feels like in terms of, does it matter for like my level of engagement with what they're trying to get across? No. And it could work both ways. So you could have a strong teacher-student relationship that actually has a negative impact then on the ability to kind of push and challenge in a certain way. But I think that, you know, you were talking earlier about the environment in which learning's happening. And so some of the peripheral stuff within that, some of kind of, you know, being someone who feels approachable and feels like will answer questions that students have, that those are things that come through really strongly on the student evaluation things that we see, that they're across the board. Students tend to feel like everyone knows stuff, knows more than them, and is like a useful person to be in the room with them. But they can acknowledge that there are how different staff do that, and how they react to questions that students might have can be different. And so that can have an impact on their ability to learn and engage with that person. Is that relationship? I think it is to an extent. I think it kind of crosses over. But like, I think obviously, you know, again, it's like, if we don't want the objective of a learning activity to be fun, we want it to be some learning to happen. We don't want the objective of a relationship to be like best mates. We want it to allow learning to happen. You know, so in the same kind of way, we need to think about that relationship. And we need to be conscious that we're going to have a different relationship with every student in the room. And again, that can be a challenge, I think, where there's a perception amongst the students in the room that like some students maybe enjoy a better relationship with the educator than others. And like, are they then privileged to more time? You know, if you're in a practical group and you're going around, like there's 15 people there, do you spend, you don't divvy the time up into like, I'm going to spend 5 minutes with every person. The nature of it is that there will be some students who get more of that time. That may be because they ask more questions. It may be because they need more support. You know, we've got to be very aware of our biases, I think, in that, to be kind of equitable. But I think if we're managing those relationships in an equitable way, that builds the relationship with the cohort in a way that doesn't, if we're seen to only be kind of trying to provide information to people who ask for it or who seem more keen or whatever else. I guess my answer to that one is yes, I think it matters. I don't, but I think that we've got to think about what it is that we're trying to achieve, and that our aim shouldn't be to just have this kind of touchy-feely conception of friendship. And I think students know that. I think the people who I thought were, you know, who I would aspire to be like, I don't think they were the most kind of matey, touchy-feely people. I felt a connection when we were having a discussion, or do you know what I mean? I felt they listened to me and they tried to respond to what I said. But I also felt that, you know, they were happy to challenge. They're happy to disagree. They weren't just trying to like make me feel like, you know, it was all fine all the time, you know. So
yeah, I think I think we're probably on a similar page. I used to think that these relationships were all that mattered. So if the student cares about the work, and they often come to care about the work through how they think about you, then there's almost nothing that you can do as a teacher that's going to prevent them from learning. If the student doesn't care about the work, then it doesn't matter how good you are as a teacher, then they're not going to learn. So my whole thing was, how do we get students to care about the work? And as a teacher, I spend most of my time thinking about, how do I get my students to care more deeply about what it is that they're doing? And lately, under pressure over the last few years to increase our intake. So we're looking at scaling up our admissions. And we get to a point where we're unable to maintain any kind of meaningful relationship, you know, higher than a certain number. And I think the number is 150, but, you know, I just started thinking about this idea as we scale up learning, as we've got to take in more students, as our classes get bigger, maybe as I come into contact with more students, it's hard enough to remember their names. When you're dealing with 200 students in your program, how do I have any kind of relationship? And when you accept that you cannot have any kind of meaningful relationship with that many people, should it be something that we're actually aiming towards? And then the other thing that I was thinking about was, you know, just in terms of, you know, we talk about how this idea of relationship is really important. So the relationship you have with your patient, but patients don't come to the physiotherapist looking for a relationship. They come to the physiotherapist to get help with their back pain. So, you know, this is going to be quite controversial. But I'm saying, should we be spending so much time talking about relationship when that isn't what anyone comes looking for? Students don't come to the physiotherapy program looking for a relationship. They come looking to learn how to be better physios. Patients don't come to the physiotherapist looking to make friends. They come to help get rid of their back pain. And I'm starting to wonder if all this talk about relationship is moving the emphasis in a direction that may be detrimental in the long term.
So I think that my problem with that would be that there's lots of things that patients don't come specifically seeking and students don't come specifically seeking, but that we might be confident are important in actually relieving their back pain or in the student achieving the goal of becoming a physio, which is why they're here. And if relationship is one of those things, you know, and I guess so we should be able to kind of maybe test that out, you know, like it's a hypothesis at least, without doing like a more thorough literature. So I don't know what exactly how much is out there on that in terms of this student teacher relationship. But it feels intuitively right that actually the relationship does matter. And that the relationship, not as I say, not in terms of like being a best mate, but in terms of having a sort of supportive, challenging student teacher relationship, that would be helpful to learning. And so even though that's not, and maybe I think, I don't know, maybe I'd even challenge whether or not students aren't coming looking for a relationship. I mean, you know, if we think of, so we've just been doing interviews on this week for the next intake, you know, and a lot of what we talk about in terms of why students might want to come here, and that we hear in the feedback about why students did end up coming here, is about things like the size of the cohort and the fact that, that it feels like they've got the opportunity to have a close relationship with the teaching staff that they may not get on other programs. So I think some students are looking for that. You know, I mean, we tend to say, like, if what you want is an experience where we don't know who you are and you're one of 150 people in a lecture theatre, I wouldn't come here, because we are going to know who you are, and you're going to be one of, you know, 30 people in a cohort, or like 15 people in a practical room. So, you know, if you're not looking for that type of relationship with teachers and staff, this probably isn't the program for you. So I think there's scope for differentiation in that. But yeah, I think students want an effective relationship with their teachers. I don't think they necessarily want to be best mates, although some do. You know, I think there's also that. Yeah. But that's the minority probably. But they definitely don't want like a dysfunctional relationship. You know, and we can probably think of examples where that happens and that breaks down, and then that's problematic for like everybody. So
yeah, I think you've convinced me. I think that it's the nature of the relationship that really is important. And as I said, this is really just something that I've been questioning. You know, kind of we begin with this assumption that it's a common sense idea that relationship matters. And as I say, I've spent the last 10 years kind of privileging that relationship, working around that relationship. And so lately I've just been pushing back against some of the things that I just take for granted. And I think you're very convincing. I definitely think that those relationships do matter. And I like the idea that students may not come looking for the relationship, but we know that relationship can facilitate learning. And so I think for that reason alone, we can privilege it. I'm convinced.
Tick. another problem solved. Okay, how we do? Have we got time for another one from me?
Time for another one each. No, three more.
Three more. We're going for the full set. Okay, good. So this actually cropped up. So there was a bit of a discussion going on the Big R's thing that I've been involved in with Jack Chew and the Physio Matters podcast guys, and they were so on their website there was I was just responding last night to someone's comment there, and that they've been talking about a conversation they'd had with an academic about you know, MSK practice and what was taught, and the conception, and I'm not sure whether this was like the poster's conception or the university academic's perception, was that the role of that academic was to prepare students for placement. And so my question is our role to prepare students for placement or to prepare students for a career? And what do we do if we could conceive that there's a conflict between those two things?
I hadn't really thought about that. I think just intuitively, I have some sympathy for the position that we're preparing them for placement. I'm not convinced, I'd have to think about it a little bit more, but I'm not convinced that that is what we need to do. My concern is that the clinicians who are often responsible for physiotherapy supervision are not the best role models for student learning. So they may be very good clinicians, but I'm not convinced that they are the best people to help students learn. So when we're preparing for practice, we're not preparing people to become good teachers, facilitators, mentors. None of that stuff is really embedded consciously in the physiotherapy program. So if we are abdicating that responsibility to clinicians, then, you know, if all we're doing is preparing students to go out onto placement and we're relying on clinicians to help mentor the students through the last year or two of the program, I worry that students would be let down, because I don't see a lot of good evidence that most clinicians are well prepared to help students learn. They may want to, they may be wonderful people, they may be excellent clinicians, but I'm not convinced that they're the best people to help students learn how to learn. So I guess that's, without having given any thought to it, I guess that would be where I come down on that. I think our job is to prepare students more holistically for a career and not just to move them onto the clinical placement and leave the kind of final refining of their education to the clinicians. I would worry about that.
Yeah. So I think that there could often be the conception that like anything that happens in the university before the student's first placement is like the university preparing them for placements. And then kind of once they've gone out on placement, that then the university role is like reflection on that placement experience and maybe some additional stuff. And again, it's not something I've given loads of thought to, but the way it was kind of phrased in this comment made me think about it a bit differently and think, actually, I'm not sure. And the thing that I have thought about more often is where that conflict is. So kind of in deciding what we teach, like there are decisions that we can make and do and have to not teach like a certain concept or a certain treatment approach or something like that. If that concept is out there in practice, so I might know that it's likely that some students are going to go on a placement where that is the methodology of practice being used. That's what their expectation. There's going to be an expectation on them to kind of be operating within this way of thinking, reasoning, practicing. So if we've made a conscious decision not to even really talk about that as a model of practice before they go out onto placement, like in one sense, we've not prepared them as well as we could have done for that placement. So, you know, have we set them up for like a more challenging placement experience than they would otherwise have? On the other side of it, if we're confident that that approach is not going to be the best approach to treatment for that student to take forward into their career beyond that point, then we don't want to only teach to what the current practice is. So we've got that, you know, and I think this is where universities can cop flak from both directions, in that in some senses we'd be expected to be ahead of the curve because we should be more like research literate and kind of have that understanding of what the current best evidence suggests we should do. But on the other hand, we're undoubtedly having to prepare students for a practice. And so we end up still teaching ideas and things which the majority of the practice has moved away from, because not all of practice has moved away from it. So, you know, we're kind of pulled both ways at times, it can feel. And the risk, I think, is then that sets up like conflicting messages. So the student's experience, it could then be to go on placement with a very, you know, passionate, convincing educator who's operating in a certain way. And they can, you know, and it depends on the, so I've had students come back and have had experiences that have gone either way. So ones that have come back in and gone like, why did you not tell us about any of this? This was amazing. My educator was great. And you didn't set me up for that. And others who came in and said, I really don't know what that educator was doing. You know, if we wait until it happens to then reflect on it, you know, like that's a lot of challenge for the students, I think, to take conceptually. Yeah. So I don't know. I've got no answers there, really. I'm just thinking it around. But
so I think if we consider the fact that we've got 20 placements, every student is probably, just statistically, they're probably going to be going out onto a placement that they haven't been prepared for, just because the nature of the curriculum is such that we cannot cover all concepts at the same time. So we have to cover them sequentially. And so chances are that you're going to rotate onto a placement in your third year, and you're going to be expected to do things that you haven't covered in class yet. So just the probability is that most students, therefore, are going to move onto a placement and be expected to do things or to know things that we haven't prepared them for. I don't think we can get around that. In the beginning of the year, we often find students coming back and saying, you know, I had to manage this patient and the patient had a condition and you haven't taught me about that condition. And then we say, yes, unfortunately, that is a condition that we cover in fourth year.
I think we then feed into it. So I guess the answer that I would propose to that is that, you know, again, what our teaching should be setting students up to do is to go on placement and be confronted with all sorts of things and complexity that, like, we're never going to cover, and be able to kind of apply an approach where they can work out what they do know and what they need to know for that for that person. So you'd ideally you'd get to the place where, like, it's never a thing that the student goes, oh, but I've not learned about that condition yet, or that, because with they are fully aware that they're what they need to do in practice is to kind of go and find, and we've provided them with the skills to do that. Now, again, that doesn't happen, and a lot of that is then reinforced by educators who would kind of ask that, go, why have you not learned about that yet? Like, this is such an important thing because my area of practice is obviously the most important area of practice,
right,
and you're coming on to my placement and this really, you know, common thing that I see all the time, you're telling me that you've not even covered yet. So again, it's the expectations for the educator, for the student, and for us, you know, if they're not aligning up.
This is why inquiry-based learning and other kind of similar types of projects, problem-based learning, similar approaches are more useful than just that didactic lecturing, because the students actually then develop ways of thinking about, you know, problems that they've never seen before, that when they go out onto those placements and they're confronted with the conditions that they've never heard about, you know, they'll feel uncertain for a while, but in the day, in the moment, they'll be able to ask questions and do a basic assessment, kind of without knowing much about the condition, and then to be able to go home and, or maybe even just when they have a break later in the day, to do a little bit of revision, and to figure out what are the basics that they need to understand before going home and maybe doing a deeper dive, and then teaching the kind of skills that they need to find appropriate literature online, find the appropriate textbooks, integrate what they've learned as part of that process, note-taking, synthesis of knowledge from various sources, and then to go into the placement the next day and have a better idea, be more confident about what they're going to be doing on the day. So ideally, you want your undergraduate program to be preparing students for that kind of thinking, which I would say is not preparing them for placement. That's about preparing them for life, for practice, for the rest of their lives. And so I think that we limit ourselves if all we're going to do is to say, well, your next placement is an orthopedic rotation, and so we need to make sure that you're going to be prepared for your orthopedic rotation. I think that we can have a more broad approach to thinking about preparing students. So I guess that's what I would say about that. I'm amazed at how much time we've spent on answering four questions, but at least now we know that those problems are solved. So my last question, and maybe this doesn't have to be too long, but should we be spending less time on social media?
Yes.
Okay, done.
I did see that you were advocating deleting all apps and getting rid of these things. So I briefly deleted Twitter off my phone a couple of weeks ago. And have since put it back on. I think it's, are we using it in a useful way? And I think I definitely have a tendency not to do that, and that is problematic, or can be, in terms of it's a time waste. It depends what you're using it for. If we're using it, if it's a predominantly a professional use of something like Twitter, that's my predominant use. Although occasionally I like to just have a long running discussion with someone who's pro Brexit or something, that's just because it's like, I fancy an argument on that given day. I'm not averse to that side of things, but I try not to get into too much of that, because that can definitely like eat into your whole time. I definitely try to pick up some things that, from one of the very first conversations that we ever had, I think possibly even back when we met at a conference for the first time, and you were talking about using things like Pocket and ways of kind of using Twitter not as that kind of endless scrolling feed that, you know, you could just sit there and continue to flick and flick and flick at it, but actually kind of going, what am I using this for? And trying to pull off useful stuff that you would then want to keep from it, or use it as a way to put stuff out there for other people to see. But then I'm also conscious that if there's times when I kind of only interact with it, or if my interaction drops, then my interaction really drops because people stop talking to me, you know? So like for me, Twitter's, but you need to invest a bit of time in it to get the benefits out of it. So you need to put stuff out there, as well as be responding to other things. But you need to also be happy to respond to stuff. So it's actually fine to have those conversations which are not very nuanced and can just turn into shit. But at least, you know, at least it's getting people engaged, and it will bring some other people into it. And I don't think that's a problem. But it's how you work out at what point has your time stopped being useful that you're spending there, and being able to kind of make that decision quite quickly if you go on and there's nothing much on there that's kind of should be keeping you there. Not to keep looking for something, not to keep scrolling in the hope that something will turn up in a minute that's of more interest to you. That I guess that's kind of where I'm at with it at the minute.
I've been thinking about this for the last year or so. There's a guy called Cal Newport, very successful academic, and he talks a lot about this idea of kind of social media taking away from your time to do what he calls deep work, which is the, you know, really engaging with ideas. And originally thought about that a little bit, and I thought that sounds pretty good. And I read a book by a guy called Jaron Lanier called, I think, 10 Reasons Why You Should Delete Your Social Media Accounts or something like that. And kind of he raises this idea of, you know, it's more about the insidious nature of what these companies are trying to do. So Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, like, you know, all of these platforms, they don't really care about your well-being. It's all about maximizing engagement to sell advertising. And so, you know, you talk about scrolling through the media feed. That feed is not designed to enhance your need to gather information about your professional career. The feed is designed to show you things that the algorithm thinks that you are more likely to like or retweet. I've just been trying to, you know, be more conscious of the way that these companies are designing algorithms to influence behavior without us being conscious that we're being influenced. And then on top of that, there's all this kind of emerging research that's showing that the more time you spend on social media, the more likely you are to have negative feelings about your own life, because the only thing that you ever see on social media is everyone else having the most amazing time. And so there is some evidence that shows that the more time you spend on social media, the less likely you are to feel a sense of deep well-being within yourself about your own life. And so I've just been kind of coming across a lot of research that seems to be showing that the value that we get from social media is very superficial. You know, the one thing that has kept me on Twitter for so long is the serendipitous finding of information that matters to me. So I, like, you know, you and I started interacting first on Twitter. There's been a couple of other people who I now have kind of very kind of deep collaborations with, and we first found each other on Twitter. But if I think about how much time I spend on Twitter relative to what I've gotten out of it, it's very, very rare that those interactions have led to anything meaningful. And so, you know, we often act as if these things are the only way that we can find out the serendipitous information that we don't know that we're looking for. So, you know, the idea that Twitter is the only place that I can go to find connections with people is obviously not true. There are many other ways that I'd be able to form meaningful relationships and connections with people doing interesting work where I don't necessarily know that I'm looking for those connections. And so I've just started thinking more and more that I should probably spend less time on social media. So I deleted my Facebook account about 2 years ago, and I haven't even noticed that it's gone. A couple of weeks ago, I deleted the Twitter apps off my devices, and I can't say that it's definitely led to a better sense of well-being, but I do find that I don't miss it. I'm not concerned that it was taking up a huge amount of my time, but I definitely don't miss it. And the last thing that I wanted to mention is that finding that it's hard for me to actually keep up in any meaningful way with all the things that I'm learning. So, you know, I download 10 papers and, you know, I'm never going to read those papers. But in the moment I thought, oh, that's interesting. I'll download the paper. But that's as far as it goes. There just isn't enough time to actually engage with all of the stuff that is coming in. So yeah, that's my thinking on the topic.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, so don't use Facebook, I don't use Instagram, I don't use anything else other than Twitter. I think I've turned off notifications, I don't have anything that is like flashing in front of me to draw me into it.
Yeah.
I think it's like then it's a choice of when to go in. I think you can make and I've tried to set the algorithm so that it's as much chronological as it can be, so that it is, rather than it being entirely algorithmically driven, what I see at the top, that it is predominantly stuff that's happened most recently. And you can't do that entirely anymore, but it's at least ways of trying to like gather that control around the serendipitous nature of it, I think, rather than feel like you're just being led down a path of like, oh, look at this. It's interesting to me because my partner, her Twitter account is logged into our iPad at home, and every time you pick it up, there's like a load of notifications on the front, half of which are probably me. You go, oh, Ben Ellis recently tweeted this, and that's not my engagement with Twitter, but it makes me realise how other people find stuff and kind of get then to get engagement. And I think you're right that there are other ways, but I don't think there's a better way. I've not come across a better way than Twitter to kind of, you know, have a wide network of people who are likely to post things that may be of interest to you. You have to feel there's, as you say, it's 10% or less in terms of the feed that is actually that stuff. But actually, that's not a problem because it doesn't take very long to scroll through 100 tweets. So, you know, if a couple of those tweets are something that is potentially interesting, even if I don't then read all that stuff, that's still like a larger amount of potentially interesting stuff that is crossing my consciousness than it would be otherwise. And I think the benefit of Twitter is that it doesn't look like anyone else is having that great a time out there. So you don't have any of those negative things that you get with Facebook and Instagram and the more aspirational social media platforms. Because it just looks like everyone else is bloody miserable on Twitter. So like, I actually probably feel more positive about myself after a bit of a time on there than I would otherwise, you know.
Yeah, no, I think Twitter is very different to Facebook and some of the other platforms. I've been spending a lot more time trying to curate my RSS feeds. So I use Feedly to aggregate all of the posts that are coming in. And so in Feedly, we'll categorize, you know, various things, technology, blogs, whatever. And so I've been trying to find blogs. So people who are writing more long form content and, you know, things that are really going to engage me in a different way. And then adding them to the RSS feed so that I'm still kind of getting that kind of serendipitous discovery, finding new voices and new ideas, but it's less algorithmic. It really is me going out and finding those people. So it's a little bit more effort to set up, but once it's set up, I find that there's more content coming in that is useful and interesting. And the benefit about things like a blog post is that I put it into Pocket, and so I'm able to listen to that and I guess think about it more deeply than just, you know, the 140 or the 280 character tweet that's coming through. So yeah, it's just it's made me think about how I'm kind of my online social identity and where I'm spending my time. And I think even if nothing comes of it, I think even if I reinstall Twitter at some point, I think it's still a useful exercise. So yeah, it's just an interesting experiment. I think I want to get to the point where I'm making a conscious choice to be on the platform. I'm not feeling like I'm required to be on the platform.
Last question. I'll make it a nice, easy one then to finish. So what was your best teaching moment of 2018?
I guess there may be others, but the one that springs to mind is we just finished our exam period. And I had a student come to see me before the exams. It's an ethics exam and it's a portfolio exam. So there's one question, it's a take-home paper. And this is developing over the course of a year. So they've had a lot of writing assignments. And the student had been kind of averaging, you know, not great, obviously struggling in some ways because there's no right answer. It's all based on their clinical experiences. So they identify ethical dilemmas in their clinical practice and then they write about it. Anyway, the student came to see me and he was kind of saying he's really concerned about the exam. You know, he's been kind of fairly average over the course of the year. English is not his first language. And he just wanted to have a chat about the exam and not what to expect, but he just wanted to know where are the areas that he could improve. And one of the things that I said to him was, you know, I understand that, you know, English isn't your first language. I understand that, you know, articulating some of these difficult ideas may be a struggle. And he just kind of put his hand up and he said, no, don't make language an excuse for me. If I understand the concept, I can express it in broken language and you'll know that I understand the concept. My problem is that I don't understand the concept. And I just thought it was a really kind of insightful because he was, you know, I was looking for excuses for him And he kind of pushed past that and said, look, don't patronize me. I can't express myself very well in English, but if I understand what the concept means and I understand how to integrate it into my practice, then, you know, you will know that I understand, even if I'm not using the right words. And I just thought it was a really insightful comment by the student. And it just kind of gave me hope. He could easily have said, yeah, you're right. I really struggle with English. You should take that into consideration when you're marking my exam. And it was great. I really had to go home and I thought about that a lot. You know, how many times we maybe make excuses for students and they don't need that. And this guy was saying, you know, don't go easy on me, like because I struggle with English. I need to understand this stuff. So I guess that would be my answer. It may not be my best answer, but it's all that I have at the moment.
Well, I put you on the spot with that one, so I think that's fair.
What about you?
Yeah, I'd kind of come up with a question and not necessarily come up with a great answer. I was just thinking through. Do you know what? I'm going to say there were two things. The first one was back at the start of the year. We have some option modules in the third year, and we put together a new one for this year on clinical reasoning, which was really good and went well. And then the feedback from that was such that we decided actually this shouldn't be an optional module. We needed to take some of the content there and spread it more clearly throughout the course. So it's led to some impacts in terms of what we try and how we try and introduce this stuff in year 1, 2, 3, which has been really positive to come out of it. But the kind of moment was then having taken some of the stuff that I had done at one point with the old third years, I then did a different point with the new third years. And the new third years are the first cohort we've gone through our new program in its entirety. And so for this particular task on clinical reasoning, I was just sort of started off with a question about what is clinical reasoning? What's the kind of student's conception of that? And for the previous year, who had kind of gone through the old program, their conception was very much of something that was a cognitive process, something for them to get right in their head and to try and understand, so that they had to kind of gather the information in. It was assessment, it was putting in evidence, but it was something that they had to do. And in all of the answers that they gave as a group when we were trying to like plot this out, the patient, the person, didn't figure in their conception of it at all. And that worked really well, actually, for how the session ran, because I'd kind of anticipated that might be the case. So I then had a load of stuff that like built that person-centered idea in, and we talked about it differently. And so it felt like a really nice learning opportunity. When I did it for the new third years, their conception of clinical reasoning had the person in it right from the word go. So now I don't know. This could just be that there was a couple of people in that room who happened to have, you know, who happened to answer it in a different way. But it seemed to fit with maybe some of the changes that we tried to make in terms of what we did in year two to build into year three, so that it kind of ruined some of my session because I didn't then need to sell this idea that actually like reasoning was a collaborative cognitive process, not an individual cognitive, that we needed to be pulling on both the sort of empirical kind of element of it and the narrative side. And so it meant that we moved on and we touched on some of that. I've made some kind of running changes to the kind of teaching stuff that I was going to do in the session. But that was a real feeling of like, do you know what, I think maybe I don't need to make as much of a thing of this now because it's clicked earlier. And so that, yeah, that was a really positive.
It'll be interesting to see if that carries on now that you've made the changes in the earlier years, or if it was just a once-off where this class was kind of uncommonly, you know, insightful.
Yeah, so ask me again next year and I might feel that was like my worst teaching moment of 2019 was when I totally didn't have that moment again and had to go back to like maybe the person, guys.
Cool. Well, yeah, I thought this went quite well. Three questions went on far longer than I was expecting. I thought, you know, we'd be lucky if we hit 20 minutes, but we've done quite well, I think.
Thank you for everyone who's stuck it out to this point listening to us.
I'd be amazed if there's anyone still listening at this point.
But if you have been listening and you have any thoughts on any of those questions, then we would love to hear you on social media. But don't tweet Michael because he's not going to see it. But you can tweet me and we can carry on that discussion there.
Yeah.
But I hope everyone has a good 2019 and we'll hopefully see you next year for some more podcasts and other activities within Beta.